Hello and welcome to the Matt's Movie Reviews Podcast. I am your host, Matthew Perkovich, and this is episode number 592. Out now on digital is Frankenstein Legacy, a gothic horror set 100 years after the events of Mary Shelley's novel, where now Victor Frankenstein's journals have fallen into the hands of a gifted scientist who will stop at nothing to cure her husband's degenerative illness. Starring Juliet Aubrey and Philip Martin Brown, Frankenstein Legacy delves into the themes of mortality, power, and madness, and also marks the latest film from director Paul Dudridge, who I have to say joins me now on a podcast. Paul, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thank you so much for joining me again. I remember last time we spoke about The Invisible Man, and now we're going into Frankenstein Legacy. You're joined now a lineage of filmmakers who've dived into the Frankenstein character in that world, which I think from the foundations of like cinema, Frankenstein has always been there. All the way back, I think it is even a movie, like all the way back to like 1910 or so of like Frankenstein and such. And a lot of people, of course, know the 1931 Todd Browning movie. What do you think it is about the Frankenstein story now that you are a part of that club that really appeals to storytellers, that appeals to filmmakers, and that really makes them want to dive in to that world and into the themes that Mary Shelley wrote about so many years ago?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately it's about bringing back, or, you know, in our story anyway, about bringing back a loved one because they can't accept the fact that they've gone. I think, you know, you're talking about when you bring someone back, about what constitutes a soul, what makes someone a person. It's just not their body. It's just not that they can see and walk around. It's what are they thinking? You know, what are their needs and their wants, and do they understand things? So I think, yeah, that was the appeal to me. And especially in this particular story, the fact that, you know, you're not just creating, that, you know, like in previous Frankenstein pictures, they're creating body parts and they make a person. But the fact that with our version, they're bringing someone back that they love because of the fact that they can't accept the grief or the loss or whatever it might be. So, yeah, that's kind of what appealed to me, you know, about doing it. And that's, we actually changed the script from the original script that I was given into this more family orientated project, rather than it just being someone that's making, someone out of, you know, desperate body parts, so to speak. So, yeah, it was the human angle that appealed to me.
The movie is set 100 years after the events in Mary Shelley's novel. Was that always the idea to have like this set in the Victorian era, 100 years after the events of that first novel? So you can delve into things, not only, you know, the themes that we talked about, but also class and sex issues as well, in regards to, that time, which I think still, in some cases, still kind of relevant today as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I just come off of Fear the Invisible Man, which was set in that time period, I think I knew a little bit more about that era rather than the time directly around Frankenstein, which is like, what, 1790. So, yeah, that kind of appealed. And I think, yeah, there was a little bit more issues to sort of, explore. And one of the things, the writer of this, Jim Griffin, you know, he wanted to bring in those elements of the fact that women weren't allowed to, you know, to take examinations. And it was just on the cusp of that kind of change. And then the social classes and things like that, even down to like the asylums at the time, about what people were, you know, put away for, and what, you know, how little it was that to get someone locked up. I think we have it in our movie where, you know, one, you know, a man who's a friend of the asylum superintendent actually gets his life, he wants his wife put away for writing poetry. And it's just, yeah, like, you know, it's that type of thing where it just gave us a lot more to explore in that era, as well as it being a little bit more familiar to me. Which I think is important to sort of know the playground that you're in and what you can do and what you can't do. And, you know, when things started to happen, just so you're a little bit more accurate from that point of view as well.
And the other thing that really strikes me is this is a film that talks about power, power from, you know, when it comes from the character of Millicent, who's played by Juliet Aubrey. She's kind of like the mad professor in this case, the power that she has to try to reanimate her husband, bring him back to the dead, but also the power where she's essentially sourcing her goods, I guess you could call them goods, in a sort of way from like poor, like downtrodden people. And there's actually a great quote in the movie where she kind of refers to like poor people as ants underfoot. She won't stop for ants underfoot as one advances towards greatness. It's kind of like, you know, these people don't mean anything to me because what I'm kind of achieving here is like, you know, something that's going to be beyond, you know, class or society, anything else. I'm going to achieve something that's going to make me into a god almost. And that's a kind of a important aspect to the movie as well.
It is. And also, I think that just points to she's just completely blinded in her goal. And it's just this, everything else is outside of that. And how she treats other people, including her own family. You know, it's not just the poor people under, you know, which are the ants underfoot. It's actually, it becomes even closer to home than that. She considers her own son expendable, you know, in order to achieve her goal. And that's, I think that just helps all those layers of that obsession and what she's prepared to do and the consequences. There are, well, the, you know, she's not even considering the consequences. There's no moral dilemma at hand. It's just this driven machine. It's almost like a Terminator, you know, you can't reason with it. You can't talk to it. You can't take it off its path. She's just on this mission. I think that's where part of the chills and the horror comes from as well, that she's almost, you know, kind of, she hasn't got that moral center that the rest of us have. And the fact that she's prepared to go to those places, that's part of the horror, in addition to the cut up bodies and all that kind of stuff.
She has like a cold obsession to her. And Juliette Aubrey plays that so well in the movie.
Yeah.
What was it like casting her, working with her on the character of Millicent? Because I'm sure, you know, it would have been great to have like a BAFTA-winning actress on your production working with this on you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Juliette was great, and she brought a lot to the table, just kind of thinking, you know, she wanted to tweak a few things, just tweak a few lines. She had her own thoughts on her haircuts or what she should wear. But I think she really got the character about what we were trying to do. And you know, it was very interesting. I think because she's done quite a lot, so she's used to, you know, the procedures, and she's used to how it is on set, and she knows what she's doing. So there's the shorthand there that you don't have to explain too much, or she just gets the character and she gets the essence of it. So we had a few meetings beforehand just to talk about, you know, what we wanted to do and what I wanted to do, as well as how she likes to work, because that's important, that, you know, she might like to, you know, as an actor, does she want to go first on camera? Does she want to go last? Does she warm up to her takes? Does she feel that she's very, you know, almost out the gate, she's good on take one, so I need to be ready for that? Does she like to rehearse or not? So all those kind of things, and especially when you're working with an ensemble cast, you have to balance that against the other actors in the scene that might have a different way of approaching to that. So you kind of, yeah, it was very interesting to work with her and have her on set.
Philip Martin Brown plays the creature in the movie. What's really interesting about how the creature is portrayed in this film, and I haven't seen every Frankenstein film, I've seen a few though, I don't really remember any of the previous films you actually see who the person was before the abomination. I don't actually remember that. That was clearly something very important for this role though, because you need to see why Millicent was so obsessed to do what she can for this man, because for all intents and purposes, her husband is an incredibly sweet, good-natured man, you know, totally opposite of her kind of like cold demeanor. So how important was it to make sure that you portray the man first before you even get to even an inkling of the creature afterwards?
I think it was very important. And, you know, all of that needed to be set up. And we actually wrote a scene when the father and son bond a little bit, and he actually takes a moment to say, hey, look, you know, I love you. I don't know how long I've got left, but I needed to say this, and just have that bond and set him up and put him in a particular direction. And also, I think we tried to make a lot of the scenes with Philip at the, you know, in the early part of the film, you know, quite light. You know, he's having not fun by any means, but there's a little bit of banter back and forth, and just to sort of pitch that character somewhere, there's some levity to it, so that when he does become the creature, there's somewhere to go dramatically and emotionally, that fact that he's not what we've seen before. But Philip had a big challenge on his hands, really, because he's essentially playing two parts. And, you know, we would seesaw between each, you know, on the schedule between the creature and him, you know, and he had to sit in the makeup chair for like 5 hours. And then they got it down to like 3 hours and you know, things like that. So it was very, you know, and Philip was saying that he loves mask work. And as soon as you put a mask on, you can everything, you can hide yourself behind it. So it was very interesting as an actor to have that opportunity to, you know, to be able to hide that. And then obviously play the two different parts, you know.
When it comes to a Frankenstein movie, there's so many different ways you can play the kind of like the more kind of, I guess you could call it the body horror kind of aspects to it. You could go really gory. You could go light. In here, kind of, if it's a nice kind of like in the middle there, you didn't want to go too bloody, but you didn't shy away by certain things as well, because we are dealing with, you know, a person who's been put together by, you know, other carcasses and so. When it comes to that aspect of it, was there much talk about how much you wanted to go down the road of goriness, blood, anything like that in your production? Because I'd imagine with a horror movie, especially horror movies these days, some of them anyway, they kind of like to go a little overboard with it. And the restraint that I found in your one, I've actually found kind of refreshing in a certain way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. Because we did, I think, you know, I thought about that quite a lot, because I'm not personally partial to a lot of gore and blood. And I think, you know, what we wanted to do was make sure that we have that human undercurrent, that heart, and that emotion that follows through. And it's like any genre film, you know, if you look at an action picture, you know, if a car explodes or rolls down the street and all the rest of it gets riddled with bullets, if we don't care about the person inside, it's all moot. It doesn't make any difference. But if we do care about it and then the car blows up, then, you know, it's great because we've got what we're looking for on both sides. And I think horror is the same. There's a lot of horrors out there that are just about jump scares and like, hey, look, there's this creature with sharp teeth, he's there and then he's not, you know, with a company with some duh-duh moments. And it's like, but, you know, if we can care about the character that's facing that, and then, or some kind of emotional connection. I mean, one of my favorite horror films is The Fly, the original and Jeff Goldblum's version. And it's like, because there's an emotional attachment to that, as well as the gore or the fact that his face is falling off. So yeah, we talked about that with Frankenstein Legacy, where we didn't want a lot of gore. We wanted to make sure that we kind of hit that 12 or 15 sort of certificate family audience, that you might get a couple of the younger audiences kind of going, you know, hiding behind their hands for a little bit, but or wincing a little bit at some of the, you know, the sort of stitches through the flesh type stuff. But there was never any kind of splattering of blood or throats being slit and sprayed everywhere and things like that. That was never my intention, because we're not making that film. We're making more of a, dare I say, a cerebral horror, where it's about the family and the emotional undercurrent. And then the horror, like we said earlier, is like through Juliet's character, not really necessarily through the fact that you're sewing skin together and that the leg's gone gangrenous and you're gonna have to chop it off. That's all kind of a little bit more off screen. So that, yeah, it was definitely something that we were aware of, and you know, the producers were as well, because they were concerned that they, you know, you don't want to get an 18 certificate and you lose half your audience, or you know. But yeah,
the Matt's Movie Reviews podcast is brought to you by Fandango. Get the latest showtimes, guarantee tickets, browse Rotten Tomatoes scores, and watch trailers with Fandango, the number one movie ticketing app. The Matt's Movie Reviews podcast is brought to you by TeePublic. TeePublic is the world's largest marketplace for independent creators to sell their work on the highest quality merchandise. With over 1.2 million designs, TeePublic is sure to have something you will love. The Matt's Movie Reviews podcast is brought to you by Gift Card Store. Australia's leading provider of gift cards, Gift Card Store offers a variety of prepaid MasterCard and Visa cards in physical or e-card format. You can even design your own card as the ultimate personalized gift. With Gift Card Store, you can gift the gift you know they will love. Please support Matt's Movie Reviews on Patreon. Get access to exclusive content, request movie reviews and top 10 lists, and help support my work. Please click on the Patreon link in the description below. When it came to where we see Philip in all of his glory as the creature itself, and he's like shows his dominance and his power, and we finally see him kind of like his full, you know, figure and everything. It struck me how when it comes to putting a character like that. I can't think of another character that has such a significant, iconic figure to him than the Frankenstein monster, because of the stuff that they did with back in 1931 and such, with the bolts and everything else. And there's been different ones all through the years. So when it came to you creating your creature, what did you not want to do? What did you not want to repeat? What did you want to make sure that you wanted to make something that was not only grounded? Because I found this one to be a much more grounded creature compared to the other ones, but also want to make sure that it was yours, so there wouldn't be any comparison to any others.
Sure. I mean, we were quite aware that actually Universal owned the rights to the, like, the grey skin, the flat forehead.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I think there's a list of four or five things that literally, if you put them in your film, you'll probably get a phone call from the legal department. Right. So with our designs, we went to a creature designer, or called Paul Hyatt, who did some sketches for us and drew up some ideas. And one of the things that we wanted to include was, really show the fact that it's made up of different body parts. Mm-hmm. So you have different colors of skin, different ages. You know, we've got a tattoo which we set up that is taken off one of the patients in the asylum, and we can really get this impression that it's been put together. It's not just an actor with some stitchy makeup on. We want to really show that there's two different parts of two different bodies put together here. So that was what we wanted to show, and then obviously still keeping the essence of the character underneath, which is Philip, and his face, so he's recognizable. We don't want to make it too different to how Philip looks. But yeah, it was, you know, during the production, it was a real juggle with me, because I've never really done heavy makeup at this extent before, and the length of time it takes to put this stuff on, and you have to factor that into your schedule. So we had to go through the schedule and go, what's being seen here in scene 53 is just a close-up on his wrist. Okay, fine, that's all they need to do. But scene 102 is full head and, you know, torso, body. That's right, that's a five-hour makeup session, so let's plan for that. And then also just filmically, because we kind of shot it in leading up to his big reveal, it's just done in close-ups on his eye, or close-ups on his hand, or little snippets of things. We don't fully reveal him. And then there's a scene later on when Millicent stands up and walks face to face with him, where we fully reveal him in his, you know, in his all his glory. So it was a mixture between slowly revealing the character on screen and also making that part of the filmmaking process and schedule, so we're not waiting around for 3 or 4 hours every day for Philip to walk on set, film in, you know, in two shots, and then he gets, you know, kind of derigged. So it was a real nice, or kind of a challenge to kind of mix the two narrative issues that we want to do and then the practical side.
So we touched on the practical side, and on the other side of this, you have visual effects side as well.
Yeah.
And it comes down to, when I talk to independent filmmakers, the struggle to make sure you can put together, get the right visual effects, get the budget enough for the visual effects so it can fit on the screen as well. And I've got to say, it's quite impressive what you guys pulled off here. You have the ships, you have the train with the bridge, the rat. So it looks great as well. I'm sure there's a bunch of other stuff I probably don't remember off the top of my head. But to put that together, I think it was 200 VFX shots in the movie. So to put all that together and get it done, but do so under the budget I'm sure you had, and under the limited time you probably had to work on as well. What was that like? And how much working on Fear the Invisible Man and the experience you had working visual effects on that really kind of like bled over into Frankenstein, and you kind of learn the lessons and learn your things and now that you had a little bit of experience of it underneath your feet?
Yeah, sure. Well, our visual effects supervisor is Al Tabret, and he did a cracking job, and we learned a lot on Fear the Invisible Man. We had 400 visual effect shots on that, and you covered everything from, you know, sky replacements to full CG characters or whatever. So there was half the VFX shots on this film, but we kind of carried over a lot of that. And the rat was something that, once saw it in the script, we realized that obviously you can't train a rat to open its eyes on you or anything like that. So we knew that was going to be a VFX shot. But we had done a commercial about 5 years ago, which featured a polar bear. So we had experience of doing a CG animated character with fur, white fur, funny enough, And so we knew how to do that. So it was just about transferring that across to the rat and then setting the shots up and the background plates to allow for that rat shot. And when is it a practical rat, which is just, you know, kind of been cut in half, you know, and stuffed. And then when is it a CG rat? When does the CG rat take over? So, yeah, I mean, you know, we also had sky replacements. We had the train, like you say, the ships. You know, the opening shot, it was, you know, we took a chance there, really, having the opening shot of the movie being a fully CG and it being on for like 20 seconds long, because the trick with CG sometimes is if it's on screen for quite a short period of time, the audience don't quite know that CG, they can't look around and check the frame and see where the matte lines are or the or poor green screen or whatever. But if you hold the shot for a long length of time, it has to be kind of as best it can be to hold up to that. So that was a big effort, but I really wanted to kind of have something fairly grand for the opening. And also, just if your film is set in the Arctic Ocean, you know, we can't go there to shoot that. So you're looking at a CG element to that. But I you know, we did a lot and in a short space of time, and Al did a cracking work, really. So, and then there's just the electricity stuff that we had to put in as well. Which the issue with that is, it's not just about overlaying electrical sparks. It's actually having the light of those electrical sparks affect the background. And especially if Millicent's throwing a switch and there's some blue electrics on the wall, that has to spill onto her face. So that was the trick, or that was the issue that we had with a lot of that as well.
Filmed in Bristol, is that correct? This is where the majority of it was filmed?
Yeah, in the southwest of the UK. So we shot majority of the film in North Devon, a house location. And then we did a week at the end of the schedule in a prison up in Gloucester for the asylum. And then we had a few other days dotted around in Bristol and a few other places. But the majority of the picture was shot in the southwest, yeah.
Whenever I talk to filmmakers about shooting, like in, like, you know, places like small towns or villages or what have you, it always talks about how the community, like, so always come together and help out and take part, and maybe, you know, might cast like a person here, a person there, and might have them involved. Did you have that type of involvement from the community yourself? Did you have people a part of the movie that maybe were like, you know, hanging out someday and you're looking for extras and you got them in the
scene? We did, actually, and I give credit to the owners of the house, Mikey and Claire, who basically, when we were down there, you know, I needed a day. The very first day we had a horse and carriage scene where the family come back from the funeral, and I had a horse and carriage contact. It was based in York, and I was talking to a couple of others. And then after conversations near the time of shooting with the location, and she said, well, a friend of ours owns a horse and carriage down the road from us, about 2 miles down, and they use it in Poldark and a few other things. So we brought them in, and it was a lot easier then to shoot, and they were local. And they had a lot of local friends who wanted. We had a scene when out the back of the house where a lot of the villagers gather to see the effect, because the creatures had been attacked or attacked another villager, so they all circle around. So they said, oh, we've got a few people in the local area that would love to be involved, and they came around, and we put them in costume and a bit of makeup, and they loved it. But there's actually one location that we were really struggling with, which was a church, and we couldn't find a churchyard that would let us dig a grave, understandably, really. And it had to be the right churchyard, and they also had to be able to give permission. And we found, what I think our line producer found, a church down in Devon that was very kind of amenable, and they said, yeah, we'll let you do it. You know, we like what you're doing, and the fact that you're local and you're down in Devon, and I think they knew the owners of the house, and they let us do our scene. They really saved us, because we were having a lot of problems finding a churchyard or, you know, a cemetery that would let a film crew come in, and let alone dig a hole. And they even hired their grave diggers that would do the job normally to come in with their digger, and they did the hole for us and everything. So it all worked out. So it ended up being quite a nice sort of community environment.
That's awesome. I love hearing stories like that. I think it's really cool when you can have like people take part and be part of like what they call like movie magic, right? It's just and it leads for a great story as well. Okay, so we had Fear the Invisible Man. Now we've got Frankenstein Legacy. But your next film, though, from what I've read, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of like a, was it a space western of some sort? Is that correct?
It's a western, not a space western, a supernatural western.
Supernatural western, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so we're delving into like a supernatural western now. So in that context, how far along are you in that supernatural western, the next project?
Well, it's we're casting at the moment and drawing the budget together and just putting, you know, kind of in pre-production, just kind of development. And we kind of would like to shoot maybe at the end of the year or early next year over in Spain. So we're pitching it as True Grit meets Ghostbusters.
Right.
So it's family, supernatural western. This would be the third film, which is actually set in like 1890 for me. So, I mean, the fourth film, I'm definitely going to do a contemporary
film. The 1890 trilogy.
It is. It could all be a shared universe, you know, like over in America.
Yeah, for sure.
This ghosty town going on. We could throw some references to the characters in Frankenstein Legacy. Yeah, so this script's been written by Jim Griffin, who also wrote Frankenstein. And we've got that, you know, locked down. You know, we're really happy with the script. And it's a nice kind of an ensemble thing. We find a woman who walks into a saloon in a town and basically says, look, I need some help. My sister's been kidnapped by this gang, and she's been held for ransom, and I need someone to help me escort me to this town where she is, and it's this town called Progress. And all the people in the saloon kind of look away and kind of mumble, and you know, they all know that the town of Progress is haunted. No one's there. It's complete, you know, ghost town. So this one cowboy, Ethan, decides to take her up on an offer for a bit of money, and they do this little road trip across the mountains to take her to this town. So we're cross-cutting between their journey and the sister who's held, you know, by the gang for ransom, and what they're up to and what their motives are. So yeah, it's fun, it's lighthearted. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to making it.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. It sounds awesome. But until then, everyone out there listening, Frankenstein Legacy, available on digital, so you can find it just at your Amazons, your Skybox, I think I might have.
Store, well. Yeah, Google Play, mm-hmm. And iTunes, yeah.
Awesome. And I recommend everyone check it out, because I think if you want to watch a really cool kind of like period set, a horror movie, and if you like Fear of the Invisible Man as well, you really dig Frankenstein Legacy. And Paul, I thank you so much for your time today. Congrats with another film. I mean, I think we spoke, last year, wasn't I? I'm pretty sure. So
yeah.
A year later, here you are, second film underneath your in the coffer. So that's really cool, man. And congratulations to you.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me, Matt. Thank you very much.